The views expressed on this podcast are only those of the individuals featured on the show and do not in any way reflect the official policy of the United States government.
You are listening to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We believe wealth isn't just about finances and money. It includes health, relationships, and anything else that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We interview members of the foreign affairs community to see how they're building wealth, both personally and financially, no matter where they're posted. This is your host, Tanya Salsa. Let's get to today's show. We're joined today by William Carrington, the owner of a firm called Carrington Financial Planning, which is a financial planning and wealth management firm that specializes in working with the foreign service community. William founded this firm about 10 years ago and has worked with more than 500 clients from the foreign service since its inception. He was also an eligible family member, a member of the foreign service community for 24 years, and his wife retired in 2018, and now he works and lives in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Sounds pretty nice right now. So welcome, William. Thanks so much for being here. So to kick it off, you know, there's a lot of financial advice online. There's a podcast like this one. There's lots of free resources out there. In terms of personal finance and investing that, you know, run the gamut from all different kinds of issues, right, that somebody, especially who's new to investing and figuring out their wealth, might look at, you know, there's a lot of free online stuff. What extra value can a financial planner add to the free resources that are already out there?
Well, a financial advisor would know which voices to listen to, would have done the research and cut through a lot of this chatter we hear today. Everyone seems to have something to say on whatever topic interests them, and especially investments or any sort of financial planning advice. And a lot of the advice, first of all, is not sound. And a lot of it doesn't really apply to the foreign service community. Much of the popular financial press in the U.S. is geared toward people who don't participate in the foreign service benefit system or the, you know, U.S. government benefit system. So they don't have pensions and other, the other component. So a lot of that stuff you might read in the popular press doesn't really apply, a lot of it. And then there are a lot of opinions given by folks on various websites, which just are not sound. And they just, it's sort of irresponsible in some ways, because the people giving the advice, they're not on the hook for the results of the advice that they give, as an advisor would be. So I think that's part of the problem is, that's part of the issue is the advisor will cut through the chatter, help sort things out, and at least a fiduciary advisor will then hopefully provide a client with all of the various options available for investing and in insurance and whatever else they're advising on, not pushing any one particular agenda, but letting them know what's really available, what's the most cost effective, and what's historically worked out the best for most clients.
William, I'm curious, you mentioned that you said a lot of the things that are in kind of the popular press don't actually apply to the foreign service community. I mean, do you see people sharing tips about things that are maybe that should be right for other investors, but not for the foreign service community? Can you give an example? I'm curious.
Yeah. So they'll say, oh, I've read that you need to have $2 million saved up for retirement. And so they're saving, they're maximizing their TSP account throughout the entire career. And I run very Monte Carlo simulations for long-term projections for retirement. And a lot of foreign service these days are going to be overfunded for retirement. So we've found that usually for most foreign service who've met most of the common milestones by the time they're ready to retire, whatever amount of money they have in their TSP account, let's say at about age 60, they're going to have that same amount in today's dollars at the end of their lives. So if they retire with about $800,000 TSP, they'll probably have $800,000 when they're 90s or some multiple of that. Or in some people, they're saving far more than that. They may have $800,000 by the time they're 50. And so then they'll come to me in their late 50s and they'll go, you know, we're really worried, you know, can we afford to retire? We really don't think we can. And I look and go, wow, you could have retired 5 years ago. And, you know, you're going to end of your life, you're going to have $2 or $3 million left over. And that's a big shock. And they'll say, well, I thought I needed $2 million. And I said, well, the net present value of the Foreign Service pension is $2 million. So you've already got that when you got your 20 years at whatever age you have that. So that's sort of a missing piece that a lot of folks don't understand. So I think, first of all, we always say retirement planning has to come first, because retirement is the one thing in life for which you cannot borrow. So when you get to retirement age, you got to have your game face on. You got to be ready to go. So there's no do-overs with retirement prep. But foreign service, you know, it's pretty easy in that the three components, four components, Social Security, the pension, those two things are automatic. You know, you don't have any control over those except for how long you work. The more long you work, the more those, the greater the value of those. And then health insurance, you get to keep your health insurance and the government continues to pay 70% of the premium as they do while you're employed. Then the other variable, you know, it's a thrift savings plan, TSP. You should maximize that when in the years you can, but not with the idea that you have to maximize it over all other goals, because everyone will have other financial goals along the way. It's either paying off student loans, unfortunately, maybe saving up for a first home purchase, college funding for kids. And these are all sort of competing goals. And you can push those forward, each of them, try to advance them a little bit each month, but keeping equal, well, I guess, weight on their importance. But there's plenty of time to get enough money in a thrift savings plan because the annual contribution limits are so high now. And so I find that folks will err on the side of putting more money in the TSP when they should have been doing something else, primarily like getting started buying their first home early enough. That's, if I've heard one big regret from folks in the investment and it's all this investment discussion, it's probably that they either didn't get started buying a primary residence first, or they didn't buy enough rental properties sooner. They kind of find that they've got a kind of a knack for this and they wish they'd gotten started sooner in that particular area.
Music to my ears, preaching to the choir. I find it interesting, actually, because, you know, there are those people that are really adamant that you should never borrow from your TSP, right? It sounds like you don't think that way. I mean, is there some merit to that claim that you should just not touch it at all? I mean, it sounds like you're advocating that, yes, you can borrow from it. And, you know, how much is too much to borrow? Should you pay it back right away? Kind of what's your views about that, about borrowing from the TSP?
Well, when TSP was first started, you know, it was pretty hard to get money into it. You put in what 5% and then 7%. It was difficult to get much money into the TSP. So I would always cringe when someone said they would take it out, they were going to borrow from their TSP, because it was hard to get that money back into it. But fortunately, there are some guardrails. You could only borrow $50,000 at any one time. So that's good. And for a general purpose loan, you have 5 years to pay it back. So you take the money out and then you have to put it back. However, most people, that $50,000 will not impact them very much at all. You can't take out $50,000 until you've got more than that. You can only borrow a maximum, I think it's 50%, 50,000 or 50%, whichever is lower. I think I state that. And, you know, so I've run lots of models where I would take someone, let's say they have $300,000 in their TSP or $250,000, and I'll just reduce it by, in the plan, just lop off $50,000 and never pay it back. Then it has absolutely no impact whatsoever long term. So, friends, in many cases, borrowing from the TSP can be a really good idea, because really what you're doing is you're shifting stock market equity into real estate equity. But you're not throwing the money away. You're shifting it from one asset class to another, and you're leveraging that. The interest you pay on the TSP loan is the G fund rate, which is super low, like 1.3% now, something like that. And then the interest you pay goes back into your own account. So it's one of the best, a really great benefit that folks have for borrowing money for a down payment, or really for anything, but most importantly would be for a home down payment.
So are you saying that that's not actually in your models, the case that these loans don't have a big impact regardless of when you take it out? Or is there a certain time where, you know, say they make the most sense?
Well, it's always going to be better to front load your investment accounts. The more money you can get in sooner, the more it's going to grow. So, and if you're starting out and you've got just $100,000, if you were to take out $50,000 at that point, that's going to have more of an impact than someone who's further along and has $350,000 and they take out $50,000. Sure. So borrowing a large amount earlier is going to impact the TSP. But what it's also going to do is get you further along the road in home ownership. I should say a real estate, I think a first home loan from TSP, I think you have 10 years to pay that back, not 5 years. So there are a couple of options with the loans.
So, William, I have a question. So someone who's just starting out, right, in the Foreign Service, let's say they're an A-100, should they get a financial planner? I mean, especially since a lot of people start, maybe they join from Peace Corps or they're just out of college with a lot of college debt. I mean, is that the time to get a financial planner? You mentioned that a lot of people come to you in their 50s and they've got, you know, a substantial nest egg. But when's the right time to hire somebody? Is it too early when you first start?
I've had at least two, maybe more clients who contacted me pre-A100. They knew they were going to the Foreign Service, previously employed, had a benefit system and wanted to understand this system, really wanted to get it set up right. And kind of the same with the other person. So then, and it helped. And one person liked the experience so much, he referred me to his parents. And so I think it's not, I'd actually like to speak to the A100 classes if possible, because its benefit system is unique. And if you could understand, if A100 folks really understood what decisions they need to make early on, and the financial security this can provide, then I think that they would enjoy the Foreign Service experience more than they may love it to start with. I think they would have enjoyed even more, because they could have a sense of financial well-being earlier in life. And I think most any other U.S. employees in any other category that I've seen, simply because all the benefits put together are a really, really great package. And so I think that's what I would like to have people understand, is not how the benefits work, you know, what are the various options, but look at it in whole and say, look, you should have a sense of financial well-being now. Even though you may come in from the Peace Corps or grad school and feel like you have no money and feel like you're never going to have money, that's not the case, because each pay period you're going to be contributing to through savings plan, Social Security, your pension, and little by little, through a slow drip process, wealth is going to sneak up on you. And if you just get up and go to work every day, then this will happen. And it's happened, you know, tens of thousands of previous Foreign Service employees, and it'll happen to you too. But except for most of those, they had some financial angst all along the way when they really probably really didn't need to.
It does sneak up. Yeah, I like that description. Because suddenly you're like, whoa, wait a minute. Yeah, what do I do with this? I think that's actually a more common problem I see of like people, you know, they're like, oh, I did a couple tours and all of a sudden I have this money and it's in the savings account and I don't know what to do with it. I'm like, what a good problem to have, right?
Oh, yeah, I think that's probably maybe the primary reason people first reach out to me, is they'll say the money has started to pile up in our savings account while we're overseas, and we don't know what to do with it. We're not really sure how this is happening. And then more importantly, we don't know what to do with it. So that's kind of common. I call that an inflection point, where your core basic living expense of life, you know, that's a fixed number for most families, what it costs to live, food, clothing. And that's mostly what people, entertainment, that's what people mostly pay for in the Foreign Service when you're overseas, because you don't have housing costs and just about everything else is paid for. So they have this kind of small core living expense, and then their income, their salary coming in just covers their needs, or then a little bit more. Then when you get overseas, you have a little bit extra more padding. Then as your salary starts to go up, your discretionary income increases. And the core stays the same, the spending stays the same, and then the discretionary goes up and up and up. And then you can have quite a bit of discretionary piles up. I mean, I've had some folks contacted me, let's say they were mid-career, maybe FS2 tandem couple, and they had about $14,000 per month of discretionary income. And so that's a lot of money to work with. And that's, they weren't a unique, special situation. That's just pretty typical for Foreign Service, and you, no one's briefed about this in the Foreign Service. Nobody sits down and explains that this is coming. So I call it that inflection point, where suddenly you have a lot more cash than you actually need, and more than you kind of thought you were going to have. And I tell people who are in those situations, you know, don't brag about it. Don't call your family and tell them, because there's going to be resentment. And, you know, first thing you know, Congress is going to go, wait a minute, they've got how much money, and they're gonna go after it, because Foreign Service benefits have been on the chopping block Foreign Service has been in the sights of Congress since the 1950s, and they've chipped away at benefits and perks first, and then benefits for a long time. And so that, you know, AFSA works pretty hard to protect those benefits, and I think everyone should help them advocate because it's a really good system, and it's only as good for as long as it lasts, you know. Probably won't last forever, but it's a really good system now. So the academic research, you know, compared, you know, asset class selection, that means, you know, TSPs, GF, CS, and I, you know, the ratios of those, or if you use stocks, you know, small cap value, large cap, international, emerging markets, real estate stocks, you know, well, you know, those are different asset classes. They've compared, you know, the impact of asset class selection versus market timing, you know, jumping in at the right time, jumping out at the right time, and being very specifically focused on one particular stock. And what works the most, which has been successful by far, is asset class selection, choosing the right mix of asset classes and maintaining that without any sort of going in and out of the market. So you select an asset class that's appropriate for your risk tolerance and your investment time horizon, and you maintain that no matter what the market does. So you only change your portfolio in response to things on your side in your life that would change, but not to what's happening in the market. But getting the right asset class selection is kind of the tricky part. Most people, we talk about diversification. Global diversification is important for long-term success. And then, but recently there's been some more discussion about diversification is, you know, critically important the older a person is. When you get closer to retirement, then it's all about diversification because you want to guard against downside risk, you know, market drops. When you're younger, you want to maximize upside potential, which might mean that you take a much more focused position. So maybe you would have an all-stock portfolio, maybe no bonds. It's not advice, it's just examples. Maybe more heavily weighted towards stocks, or maybe it'd be more heavily weighted to one particular sector of stocks, or one particular or two particular companies that you would focus. You would, of course, keep your most of your money in a well-diversified portfolio, but then have focused positions on particular companies that you really felt strongly about, or particular sectors or particular opportunities. So early on, it's about risk, taking more risk, intelligent, smart risk, but risk. And that's what really separates the folks who have a lot of money and those who don't. So there's kind of two different, differentiate the two groups I'm talking about. So to be successful in the Foreign Service, all you need is a well-diversified portfolio in the TSB. All five of the indexes, you know, all five of the bonds and stocks. And then your outside TSP portfolio is very well diversified, broadly diversified across international, U.S., and stay invested all the way through. And that'll get you to where you need to be, because all the models I run, you only need about 6% return over the long run to do really well, to have a brilliant life and retirement. That's all you need. But if you want a lot more than that, then you need to have a greater return. And to get a greater return, you need to have greater risk. And the thing that separates the mass affluent, people who have from 300,000 in total net worth or invested assets to 2.5 million, so 300,000 to 2.5 million, what separates them from high net worth, people who have 2.5 million to 10 million, the only thing is it separates them is risk. And those people are usually business owners, people who have the risk tolerance to start their own businesses. Or they're aggressive investors who are very aggressive and smart about it. That's the only thing that separates them. There's no educational difference. There's no background difference. It's just simply a matter of risk tolerance.
So have you seen members of the Foreign Service community that you mentioned have attained this high net worth status, right, above 2.5 million when they retire? Did they invest in businesses? I mean, or were they just really smart about where they allocated their money?
Most in the Foreign Service don't achieve that level. It's very, very rare. Hmm. And those who do, they're usually going to be tandem who were able to maximize their TSP contributions throughout and kept a mostly heavy stock focus and stayed invested throughout. Some of them also bought multiple properties, real estate investment early on. And let's see, the others who I've noticed have stock portfolios that were created by a parent who's actually very good at that investing. Ones who have advisor-created portfolios, typically that didn't help them early on because they fell in with an advisor who worked for a big firm, you know, all the big brand names, that usually aren't fiduciaries who get them into load funds that didn't really help them. So those who've achieved some level of wealth through investing it's usually a parent, because parents, I think, have a natural fiduciary relationship with their kids. So they do a really good job of their of advising for investments. So those folks, they got a leg up with parents helping them, or they inherited, or they were tandem. For single income foreign service to start, like straight from grad school or your first job, and they come in with a little bit of money, but then build it all through the foreign service system, it's hard to really develop to have millions, you know, in investments unless you got really lucky or were prescient. And I'm still looking for the person who bought Apple when I thought I should have, but I didn't. Netflix when I knew I should have, but I didn't. Facebook when it IPO'd and dropped to $15, and I knew, but I didn't. So I'm looking for those people. No one yet. And a couple of people got Apple early, you know, the early teens, 2012 or so. But no one earlier than that I've seen. Now, maybe those folks have enough money, they don't want to talk to an advisor, but I haven't really seen that yet. So most people are kind of in the same boat, kind of missing each new wave, massive opportunity, like the internet starting or tech stocks or the thing, or Bitcoin, all those. We all hear about it after it sort of happened, and they're always looking for the next wave. That's probably what we should talk about today. You know, what is the next big wave? And, you know, so most people are kind of in the same boat, and there aren't that many people that are, you know, really wealthy in the foreign service that I've seen. Well, I think when someone's in their 20s, it's really hard to appreciate a pension, because when you're in your 20s, you think, you know, the sky's the limit. My life is unlimited. I could achieve anything. Why should I be worried about a $50,000 or $60,000 pension? You know, that may not seem like that much, or that's important early in your 20s. And I'm sure I would have thought the same thing. I would say, you know, who needs that? But as life goes on, you find the typical obstacles that most people run into, then pensions starts to look more and more important. So I would say someone in their 20s, if they really should sit down and have someone run the numbers for them, so they really could understand what they may be giving up if they left. I do have a lot of people who come to me who are after the 10-year mark and say, you know, I'm really looking at jumping out. I have a private industry opportunity. Can you tell me what I'm giving up? So I run the numbers to them for them, and it's usually, unless it's a really good private industry opportunity, and that's what they really want to do, maybe on a personal level, then usually the numbers went out for staying in the Foreign Service. And I make jokes, I call myself the Foreign Service Employee Retention Department, because once people have run the numbers, it's about jaw-dropping. If someone starts in their 20s, you know, they could retire at age 50 and have, you know, probably $60,000 a year pension that's going to last for their entire life, and they will likely be retired much longer than they worked. And who has that opportunity to where in your 50s, you would get the Foreign Service pension, the annuity supplement, healthcare benefits, and on, and eventually Social Security. And this is for the next 50 years or 40 years. So that's a remarkable opportunity. So I don't know if some of your 20s could really appreciate that. Some will, some won't, but I think they just need to see the numbers.
Speaking of numbers, William, you'd mentioned that when people are doing their financial plans, they're thinking of this like $2 million number that they need to retire, right? Like there is a lot of talk in sort of the popular press about, you know, what's your number that you need when you retire? When you sit down with a client, what is that number? And how can you, you know, realistically plan for it? Because it seems like there's so many moving parts, you know, there's like inflation, there's different things. You can't guarantee what a return is going to be year over year. You know, how do you come to that number for a particular client? And then how do you kind of reverse engineer that so that they get there, right? I mean, I've always found that part really fascinating because it seems to me that it's quite complicated with a lot of moving pieces. So how do you determine what a person's number is that they're going to need to retire at? And then how do you get them on track so that they, you know, feel confident that they can get there in 5, 10, 15, 20 years? Because again, none of us really know what's going to happen in terms of taxes, inflation, you know, just sort of the overall economic picture. I'm very curious.
So yeah, so that's a good question. So it's complicated. And you have to start by, most people will say, how much will I have? How much should I have in retirement? And that's really not the question. The question is, how much will you need? You know, what is your spending going to be? So I start, for most folks, I usually will look at them when they're first eligible to retire from the Foreign Service, what their cost of living at that point would be. you know, will they still have kids? Let's say they could retire in their early 50s. Will they still have kids going through college? You know, what will the total cost be after what I call retirement, which is Foreign Service retirement, even though they could still continue to work beyond that age? And then ultimately, when they're going to do a full stop on unemployment, like let's say in their 60s and start drawing Social Security and everything. So the question is, what does it cost to live? So there's the basic living expense. You know, that's what I mentioned before, your core spending. And then other things like if there's housing costs, periodic purchase of a new car, healthcare costs, money they want to give to their kids regularly, travel, all these things you could possibly spend money on. And you have to have, each one of these has to have a line item. And we stack them all together, all these things that you would need to spend money on in retirement. There's a lot of things. And so that's a total amount of money per year that's needed. Then you match that against their known sources of income, which is going to be pension and Social Security. And then or if they have rental income from property, that's of course added in as well, and that helps. And so the fixed sources of income are matched against their spending needs. And if there's a shortfall, which there often will be, then that shortfall has to be met by withdrawals from TSP and other investment accounts. So that's the number you go for. So, and they say, well, how much is this shortfall going to be every year? And for how many years? And if you have to take money out of your savings, you know, X amount per year for 30 or 40 years, what's going to happen to your account? And how quickly you're going to bleed this down or draw it down? And so that's, and so I use very sophisticated software that models this and shows starting from this year while you're still in accumulation all the way till retirement starts and all the way to the end of someone's projected longevity. And it goes year by year by year. And so you can plug in different variables. And then it runs a Monte Carlo simulation where it takes all of your assets and your whole plan and runs 1,000 market simulations where it has 250 simulations going forward from now to the end of your life, 500 kind of average simulations, and then 250 really poor, really terrible ones, you know, multiple great recessions, things that have never happened, looking for a market-driven situation under which you would run out of money. And for most Foreign Service, there doesn't come up with any, which is really shocking. When I first started doing this, I said, no, we have to come up with a market calamity that'll cause them to run out of money. And for most Foreign Service, that's really not the case. I've given a few milestones, and that's what's pretty remarkable. And that's why I keep going on about the strength of the Foreign Service benefit system, because this Monte Carlo simulator is really robust and it's really smart and it really knows how to come up with market scenarios that would crash your plan. And very often for certain Foreign Service, it doesn't. It may come up with some scenarios under which, you know, a person would run out of money, but they would still have their pension and Social Security. So what we're talking about is their invested assets. They would bleed them down to zero. But people don't wait until they run out of money before they change their spending. As soon as you have a couple of bad market events in retirement, they would pull back spending and then they would self-correct and they really wouldn't run out of money. So that's how you do that. And the software is incredibly powerful and very robust. It's been it's been in use now for 20, 25 years. So typically the way the math works out, a Roth portfolio versus a non-Roth, you know, like a traditional IRA, the growth is going to be the same. You're going to end up with the same amount of money in the portfolio. It's just that the money coming out of the Roth is tax-free. The money coming out of an IRA is going to be taxable. The portion that was the growth is going to be taxable. There's a big difference when you're thinking about the TSP versions. And I wish they had not called the Roth TSP Roth, because it causes a lot of confusion. Folks think that you can't have a Roth TSP and a Roth IRA. Well, you can have both and you can maximize contributions to both. The Roth IRA has an income limit, whereas a Roth TSP, though, does not. So you there are situations where you can maximize contributions to Roth TSP and Roth IRA. The big difference between the Roth TSP and traditional TSP is, since the Roth TSP is an after-tax contribution, it will decrease your take-home pay. So some people just starting out, let's say single income, Foreign Service, living in DC, they probably couldn't really afford to maximize their TSP using the Roth version, because it'll decrease your take-home pay maybe by about $300 per pay period. But the TSP on its website has a Roth TSP calculator that shows you how much your take-home pay would be impacted if you choose the Roth version. Now, a lot of people get all twisted up in these tax arguments saying, taxes are going to be lower in retirement or higher in retirement, so it's better I do the Roth now or don't do the Roth now. Most arguments are in favor of don't do the Roth now because taxes will be lower in the future. That's really not the issue at all. What the issue is, and I see people who are retiring, is that when you retire, let's say your TSP is likely to be about $1 million. When people first retire, they're going to want to make some large lump sum withdrawal for some purpose, either to pay off a home, do something significant, large lump sum withdrawal from TSP. And to take that out of traditional TSP, that's going to be taxed as ordinary income. So let's say you want to take out $300,000 to spend, you're going to have to probably take out $400,000 to pay for the taxes, an extra $100,000 just for taxes. So that's a bit of a handicap. If all that money comes out from a Roth, it's all tax-free. And then when you get to required minimum distribution age, which is 72, where you're forced to take money out of all of your retirement accounts and pay taxes on it, if it's in the Roth version, then you don't pay any tax. So those are two strong arguments for using the Roth, which is, you know, the tax-free option later. And what argues against it is to reduce cash flow earlier. So my recommendation for most people is to target at least having at least $300,000 or $400,000 in the Roth TSP when you're ready to retire. Then at least you've got some large pool of tax-free money that you can draw from. I think folks who have kids who want to get through college and they get nervous about how much they don't have yet saved up for college, they'll do a lot of the greater hardship posts and go unaccompanied, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, multiple tours if they can in order to save up a lot of extra money in a hurry. So I see that happening a lot. For successful planning, though, when I first run all these models I mentioned, the only savings I use is just TSP. I don't have not a penny going into checking or savings accounts, nothing going to investment accounts. It's just bare bones foreign service pension system. And that means just saving for talking about long-term saving, you know, all the way through retirement. I just use TSP contributions, and most foreign service plans succeed extremely well saving just through TSP. So if you're able to maximize TSP or some significant amount of TSP, that's all the savings you need to do for retirement. Honestly, in most cases, and I can't say it for everyone, so I'm not saying drop your IRAs and forget about those. That's, you know, I don't know your situation, but for most people, that's enough for retirement. And then all the other money you may want to save up could be for home purchases, real estate investments, or, you know, kids through college or student loans or whatever you want. Then you do have the freedom to do that. One regret I do hear from folks who are further along in their career is once they look and see how well off they actually are, they look back and go, oh shoot, we could have had a better standard of living all these years. We could have been going to Starbucks, you know, I think, or traveled more, and realized, wow, we didn't need to be so frugal. This is, and they have a lot of money. Of course, in the future, if they can, they can do a lot more if they can break that frugality mindset that they've gotten themselves into, which a lot of them can't. So it's kind of a real balance. So there's two kinds of financial planning. There's goals based, which says you're going to have a certain goal to meet in the future. Let's figure out how to fund that. And then there's standard of living planning. And this, I do both. And so you really have to, when working with Foreign Service, you have to do both, because they'll come to me and they'll say, you know, we're at a great standard of living right now. How can I have this for the rest of my life? Because I'm going to leave Foreign Service and I'm not going to be in London. I'm not going to be in these great places, but how can I still live like this? And so I have to help balance that out to show them how you can actually have that sort of standard of living for the rest of their lives.
I did have a question about something that's in the popular press and your thoughts on it. And that is what we would consider, like, sort of outside of, you know, your pension and your index funds, and, you know, kind of more traditional conservative investing. And that is about speculative investments, because, you know, there's a lot of froth in the market. Some might call it a bubble. Called people speculating on stimulus checks or whatever, but there's a lot of attention on it, whether it's a big IPO or these SPACs or Bitcoin or whatever. Is there a place for those in somebody's portfolio, in your opinion?
So I think that everyone who has a real interest in speculative investing, it's kind of an oxymoron, because you're not really doing both. You're speculating, you're not really investing, I guess. But, you know, so someone who wants to take a high risk focus investment, I think they probably should. You know, 5% is probably a good number, but as long as you're contributing to your TSP and you're making mortgage payments, or you've got a home that's rented out and you're doing everything else, your 529s for your kids, your student loan payments, then whatever else you might want to invest, then if you feel like you're good at that, do it. Because you're not going to do this long enough to where you're going to cause yourself to go bankrupt. As long as you don't trade on margin or short stocks when you don't know what you're doing. Because if you, let's say you take all of your saved assets, not TSP or anything like that, but let's say you took it all and bought two or three really high risk things and you lost it all, you'd get your fingers burned. You wouldn't do it again. Or you'd learn from it and next time you'd be better at it. So I think it's kind of a self-correcting situation. I don't think you should scare people away from it. I think if they wanted to start out small and try a few things and watch, see what happens. But even if they don't get those first, right, let's say they only put a few $100, $100 in a couple of speculative stocks and it doesn't work out, I don't think they should quit. I think they should just learn, you know, what happened. And I think probably what happens is they buy on emotion. So when I first started doing individual stock investing for myself, I wrote a protocol of how I would go through each purchase. And I'd like 10 things of how I do my research, everything. And the last item was wait 24 hours. No matter how excited I was, no matter how I thought I got to do this today, wait 24 hours. Then you get up the next day and go, listen, man, maybe this is not such a hot idea. Then you'll find out that that really kind of set, that takes kind of the emotion out of it. Then you can be a little more level-headed in making these decisions. But I think that, you know, there are opportunities for making a lot of money. And most people will not make a lot of money with this speculative investing. You know, maybe just a few percent actually will. But I think most people, if they want to participate, they should.
Changing gears a little bit, William, you've mentioned real estate a couple times. What have you seen that has worked well for people that have invested in real estate during their foreign service career?
First, what I call the absentee homeowner opportunity has worked really well for foreign service, where they will buy a home that they think of as a primary residence. They go overseas, they rent out the property, have it well managed by a very good property management company, and then the tenants actually pay off the mortgage for them. So a lot of people are very worried, very nervous about their first mortgage. And they say, you know, what if, you know, that's not rented? And what if this happens? What if that happens? But I think, you know, think about it this way. If you're overseas and, you know, your home is, you have this mortgage, but the tenants are legally obligated to pay the lease, right? So it's really their mortgage. It's not your mortgage. It's actually the tenant's mortgage. And if you really want to think about it that way, so they pay the mortgage and hopefully it'll be at least cash flow neutral, where the rent pays most of the mortgage. That's worked out really well. And then once someone becomes comfortable with that, then they might start building what I think of as a portfolio of rental properties. Some foreign service folks have decided this is what the EFM is going to do. This is their passion, is to buy properties with the idea of having a certain amount of rental income by the time they're ready to retire. And they may target more than $100,000 per year in rental income from maybe three or four properties they've accumulated over the years.
You know, you were Trailing Spouse in EFM for many years, and you started a very successful business. And I was wondering, on a personal note, like, how did you make your business work? What were your tips for success?
I think that what the reason a lot of Americans don't succeed at businesses is they don't have the right appreciation for what's available to Americans for succeeding. We were overseas for 16 years. I started out and I was Silicon Valley engineer. I worked for high-tech startups in Silicon Valley and large companies. And I worked for 3M Corporation internationally in Asia and Southeast Asia. So I had a lot of, you know, big company experience. And then when I came back in 2006, I decided to go into financial planning. So I wanted to do something that was more people-oriented and also followed my, you know, something I was very interested in, which was investing in financial planning and all that. So we came back to DC in 2010. And I saw the US through the eyes of an immigrant. That's how I felt, because we'd been overseas 16 years straight. We had lived in Malaysia and Japan. Everything I tried to get started there, I heard, no, you can't do that here. No. And not from the embassy, but from local government. No, can't do that. Can't do that. I said, the word is no. Can I do this? No. Can I do that? No. So we came back to the US. And I said, well, can I do this? Yes. Can I start a business? Yes, but it costs $25. But can I do this? Yes. It was always yes, but you still have to get up and do the work and all that. You know, no guarantee of success, but there were almost no barriers to getting started. And I felt like at my age, you know, I had no choice but to succeed. So what I think the reason most people succeed is the absolute fear of failure or the knowledge in their head that this cannot fail. It's not like, oh, this is an optional side business. I'm going to do some of this, see if I can make some money. That may not work out. But when you're in a situation where you feel like your back's against the wall and this cannot fail, you know, eventually I'm going to be the primary breadwinner. This has to work. And when you just start trying, there's a famous poet who wrote something about how when you first start a venture, unseen resources just sort of kind of appear and out of unexpected places. That's what kind of happened to me. And I just every day got up and just did a little bit going, boy, I don't know if this is going to work. I hope this is going to work. Wow, this is a bit spooky. And then it just fell together and just worked. I mean, it takes a community. You know, FSI reached out to me to do a lecture series for them, which made me more known to the Foreign Service. And it just took off from there.
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, obviously I have my own business too. And some of the things that you're talking about definitely resonate because you get to this point where you're like, I have to do this thing. Right. And you just go out and do it. And you're right. As long as you get up and you do the work, like stuff starts to magically happen in a way. I don't know if it's magic, but you know, you find resources, people hear about you and, you know, the Foreign Service community is a wonderful community and it's a community of trust where people, you know, share resources. And, you know, that's part of the impetus of this podcast too, which is we have really wonderful people doing fantastic things. And this is a central place where we can share ideas about, you know, investments and how to grow portfolios and essentially get all of this advice. So we really appreciate you talking to us, William.
Not at all. It's my pleasure. I'm glad you're taking up this subject and helping to spread knowledge and opinions from various sources. I think it could be very, very helpful. So thanks for including me.
If you like this episode and want more, make sure to give us 5 stars on the podcast player of your choice. And after that, check out our Facebook page. From there, you can learn about our other episodes, connect with our guests, and of course, share your own ideas for success. We'll see you next time.